Welcome to In-Depth, an in-depth look at the interesting, educational, and timely topics affecting you right here in Marion County and beyond. The one to count on for today's local news coverage is KNIA KRLS. And now with today's In-Depth, here is Dr. Bob Leonard.
What was it like to grow up in revolutionary Ethiopia? An author who recently read at the Geisler Library's Writers Reading Series at Central College shares his memories. Let's go in depth with Tim Bascom, author of Chameleon Days, An American Boyhood in Ethiopia. So, Tim, you grew up in Africa.
Right. Ethiopia primarily. Kenya, Sudan. Yeah.
How was that?
That's too big a question to answer just like that. Uh-huh. But in retrospect, it was a privilege because I was getting to be with people who are very different than me. And that was not easy. But I look back and I just feel like I was very rich. So I tell my parents, who still sometimes have tensions around the things I write, without you taking us there, we wouldn't have any stories. But I feel like I got a lot of stories because of the way I was raised.
And your parents were missionaries.
Yeah.
You managed to build two memoirs. You had one that came out a few years ago, and you've got a new one called Running to the Fire, An American Missionary Comes of Age in Revolutionary Ethiopia. And I don't even know where to start. What are the main lessons that you took from coming of age? How can coming of age in a revolution in Africa, it's just unimaginable to me.
Well, we were at the time when we went back to Ethiopia, I was only a sophomore in high school. And my parents suddenly came into the living room and they said to the three of us, I have two brothers, what would you think about us going back? We had been there for 6 years when I was quite young, and now I'd spent 6 years in a little town. And I thought immediately, at some odd level inside of myself, even though it had been very traumatic as a child to be sent off to boarding school, to live in the places where I had, to be ill oftentimes from tropical diseases, I had actually, to be honest, become a bit bored in this little town in Kansas. And a Marxist revolution had taken place. I was in this hyper-religious family. I pretty much had absorbed my parents' ethos and the way that they thought about the world. At the time, Russia was this looming presence up in the north that was seeping out over the globe. And Marxism was a doctrine that Christians who were evangelical were afraid of and very resistant to. And I had been raised in that subculture. So when they talked about the emperor having been overthrown, and when I heard about Russian consultants starting to come in and Cuban into Ethiopia, and then started hearing some of the stories of what was happening to converts to Christianity in Ethiopia, I thought if we were to go, we would be doing something noble. I thought we'd be doing something important. I thought this would be large. A lot of the reason I wrote the book was because, in retrospect, as an older person looking back, I realized that in some odd way, that year of living dangerously in Ethiopia was one of the best years of my life. And that didn't make sense because it probably shouldn't have been. It was quite traumatic. There were a lot of reasons that you would want to run away from the fire, not into it. But at that age particularly, to be coming of age as a 16, 17-year-old in that climate with the kind of background I had was dynamic, and it clarified a lot of things that were important or not. And over time, I was going to have some large questions that would rise up inside of me that would trouble me and be difficult to deal with. But at the time, it was a very rich and powerful experience. And there was a lot of solidarity, too. There, one thing about being an embattled minority is that you do really appreciate the people who you are now close to, the few who understand where you're coming from. And so that kind of bond that I think maybe military men or women might experience in conflict is a bond that was being formed within the mission. and with converts who were attached to the mission through evangelical Christianity. So those are some of the reasons that I had to write the book and some of the things that I was trying to explore and understand.
And what year was this?
This was 1977 that we went back. And Emperor Haile Selassie had been overthrown in 1974. And in 77, the revolution had basically hit its peak. So that period was later called the Red Terror, because Colonel Mengistu, who had by that time consolidated all power over the Committee of Equals, quote unquote, that was running the country and was starting a kind of counter-terrorism program against anybody who resisted, including on the hit list people who were associated with America or other Western countries, and particularly those who would be ascribing to Christian principles from an evangelical or what would be seen as a foreign religion.
More in depth after this. I continued my conversation with Tim Bascom, author of Chameleon Days, An American Boyhood in Ethiopia. Essentially, every day you felt your life was at risk, and that of your family as well?
I think that went underground, so I wasn't consciously thinking that way. But I wouldn't say that it always was at risk, but at the back of your mind, you knew that things could happen any moment. And there were moments in the book I write about, particularly checkpoints. These were where we would have to be in direct contact with whoever had authority, and they usually had a machine gun. And there were a couple of very frightening moments, one of them in a school bus where we had accidentally run through a checkpoint in Addis Ababa. Checkpoints were hard to recognize because the people who were doing it were locals, sometimes in flip-flops with a baseball hat, but carrying a gun. You didn't know who was really in charge and couldn't see sometimes what was coming. And so when we went through, suddenly we had a mounted machine gun swinging and a guy running out and cocking his rifle and dropping to his knee, and the driver fortunately braked in time, but we spent the next 30 minutes basically getting abused in a shouting and pushing and guns pointed at us way. So, yeah, there were those moments.
What were some of the big issues that you mentioned that you were having to deal with intellectually?
Well, I would posit that people have a capacity for faith to varying degrees. And I would propose now, looking back, that I had always been a doubter, a person who struggled to believe. And so some of that's almost genetic, I think. And it goes with being a writer as well. Writers often are people who will examine things closely instead of just taking the party line. But even as a child, that was just in me. So I never felt fully satisfied, fully successful in my attempt to be the Christian I should be, given all the models that were around me. And that tension was a hard thing to live with as a kid in that setting, where I was trying to, in essence, live out a kind of triumphant model as a Christian, just the way my parents would as missionaries who'd come to this country. As a person who'd lived longer, I could see flaws in the system to start with, and that kind of religiosity at times is suspect to start with. Evangelicals within the Protestant realm tend towards that triumphalism more than Catholics do, for instance, who have, I think, a better sense of suffering and its role in life and the fact that life isn't always going to turn out the way that we want to write it. And so Those are some issues. As I look back, having studied, being a grad student in literature studies, reading things by Chinua Achebe about life in Nigeria during the colonial era and others like him, thinking about the role of a missionary, I'm troubled by what has been a kind of colonial, I would say a cultural imperialism at times. And yet I say that with inner conflict because I have great respect for the people that I've known who, unlike, for instance, the author, main character in Barbara Kingsolver's novel, Poisonwood Bible, a lot of them are not the bigots that have been portrayed, people who were pretty selfless, willing to do very important humanitarian things, building hospitals, schools all over Africa. I have a lot of respect for them at the same time that I am unable to get around questioning a kind of almost militaristic desire to reach out and conquer in areas with their religious beliefs.
And how are your parents taking this, or how did they take this?
That's the hard part. They are very gracious people, and we've had our tense discussions both with the earlier memoir and this one, more so with the earlier book, because it probably struck them more personally to see me talking openly about some of the pains of being a child sent off to boarding school and basically feeling like I had been put in a second position as a child next to God's will, which is a hard place to be because God's will seems pretty important. So we had to have some hard discussions about that. Having gone through that with this new book, though there are particular issues where we disagree, I think we've arrived at a place where we understand that we disagree and yet still have love for each other. So I think they're proud that there's a book out there again, another book that chronicles some of what happened. I think they appreciate that some of the stories are being told of things that most people don't know that were occurring in Ethiopia during that time. And that includes certain figures like a man named Waja, who was jailed and tortured because of his beliefs and still showed great generosity, kindness towards even those who were tormenting him. So I think in the long run, they're happy that I'm continuing to get something out there, even if there are disagreements.
More in depth after this. I continued my conversation with Tim Bascom, author of Chameleon Days, An American Boyhood in Ethiopia. Well, in the times we're in, it seems like we're seeing revolutions everywhere. What have you learned from this that might be applicable today in these other situations?
Well, it's no longer Marxism that's the issue. Now we're looking at this Islamic movement and possible reforms within it, perhaps. The Arab Spring was an attempt in Egypt and then Tunisia and other countries across North Africa to change things. And already, if you look at the news and watch what's happening in Egypt, it would appear that that original enthusiastic attempt to get reform has been hijacked. And that what looked like a very good chance for change now could go the opposite direction. And these things get so unstable that that's what often occurs. And in Ethiopia, that's what occurred. There were people in the streets asking for something that was needed badly because there was an aristocratic medieval mindset that had kept people under as serfs on their own land, not owning it, while the aristocrats owned almost all the land in the country. And people were saying, we want land. So the main thing was they had placards and they were saying, land to the tiller. And that was a worthwhile cause. But that that attempt to change things got hijacked, and in the end, terrible damage occurred because of the way that the leadership took it after that.
Do you have a bit that you'd like to read for us?
Well, I think it never hurts to just read the very beginning. You know, this is how the book launches. The bus is swaying along 7,000 feet above sea level, covered with fine red dust, when we come upon an incredibly deep ravine and a narrow bridge and two sentries lounging behind a half circle of sandbags, with a mounted machine gun perched next to them like a praying mantis. The brakes squeal, the sentries straighten, and the old man who has fallen asleep against me starts to fall forward before catching himself and lifting his woolly head, smelling of wood smoke. "Azanalo," he says, apologizing as he pats my leg. While blood rushes back into my numb shoulder, I look to my father and see that his jaw muscles are popping. He lifts a hand to knead his forehead, where the receding hairline has created a black prong of hair. He grimaces at me in a sympathetic way. I have grown accustomed to checkpoints in Addis Ababa, where many of the neighborhood police recognize the bus from my boarding school. But here, 124 miles to the south, I know, as he does, that nothing will be predictable, especially since the two of us are probably the only foreigners these sentries have seen for a month. Westerners with Western clothes and haircuts, from America, no less, enemies of the state. And the younger one, that's me, acting like one of the Beatles, with a mop of black hair and a smile turned up at one corner as if hiding ironic thoughts. The soldiers step onto the bus, unslinging their Kalashnikov weapons. They order everyone off, and as we file forward, I spot an officer emerging from his sentry shack. He is thin and haughty, with latte-colored skin and a mouth pinned down by slit-like wrinkles. He stretches as if easing an ache. At his back are the shrouded peaks of several mountains. Down the rocky scree, beside a torrent of yellow water, lies another bus like ours, only it is flipped on its side like a discarded toy. I feel the old wariness of being back in the battle zone. For 3 weeks I have relaxed my guard while ensconced in a remote mountain pass where my parents are trying to revive an abandoned medical clinic. Out there, I have allowed myself to act as if the Ethiopian Revolution is someone else's bad dream. Now, however, the sullen sentries and the wary travelers bring it home. The war is not over yet.
Thanks to Tim Bascom for contributing to the program. For KNIA KRLS News, this is Dr. Bob Leonard bringing you today's news and information in depth from our little corner of the universe.
In Depth is available for podcast in the radio audio media player on KNIAKRLS.com. You'll find additional information, pictures, and more, or subscribe to the In Depth podcast and never miss an episode. If you have local topics you'd like to hear on In Depth, send an email to Bob Leonard at KNIAKRLS.com. The one to count on for today's news and local information is KNIAKRLS and KNIAKRLS.com.